Now, here's something you don't hear every day. A sympathetic senior figure in the U.S. government who hears the cries of refugees from Syria trying to make it to America.
I mean, if you're a Syrian and you've come to this country, it's almost guaranteed that you have really close family members who are living under horrific conditions still in Syria. It's almost guaranteed that your story of flight was unimaginable. You know, whether it's dodging bullets or the extreme cold or the worry that you weren't going to be able to feed your kids or the worry that you were going to get kicked out of a neighboring country.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power speaking on this program. But what do her words of sympathy mean to real Syrian refugee families?
This war, it sort of functioned like a natural disaster for this family and so many others. It's as if they were caught in a tornado, and it literally lifted them and hurtled them across the world.
Reporter and author Eliza Griswold experienced that tornado in her New York Times profile of a family, the Al-Hajlis, who had to leave Syria suddenly in 2012 when one member defected, putting the entire family in danger. Most eventually made it out of Syria and out of danger, but they entered into a geopolitical holding pattern that is already eroding the quality of their lives and is threatening to rob their futures. Eliza Griswold says the map of where the Al-Hajli family ended up is a map of the world's intolerance, its fear, and its inertia.
One misconception that we all have after watching these images of millions of people on the move is that this is a global migration crisis. And while it certainly is that, for Syrians and many others, that's not how it began. It began as a brutal war perpetuated by the Assad regime. And so 7 out of 10 people fleeing from Syria now are fleeing Assad. They're not fleeing ISIS. And this family represents that massive wave of more than 4.5 million people who have left the country since the war began. So we have the parents, we have Aziza and Mahmoud and their twin teenage boys and their daughter in Aurora, Illinois. That's kind of like winning the lottery. They are in the best global situation. Then two of their daughters are in, Rasha and Ruba, are in Holland. And one of them got there about a year ago through the asylum program because she was married to a man who'd been imprisoned. The sister, her little sister, Ruba, carried 3 children under the age of 7, mostly on foot and by boat and by bus, from Morocco to Holland to meet her sister this fall. Then we have Fatima, another sister who's stuck in Jordan, which has become a global waiting room in this war and people trying to get out of it. We have another sister who is Rana, who I didn't meet, in Egypt. She's in Egypt. She just had a baby, and her baby has no citizenship. Her baby is stateless. And then the last member of the family they're actually most concerned about is Wasim. And Wasim is their 20-something son who is in Jordan, who is in Amman, Jordan, with his wife, Norhan, and 2 little boys. And he's not allowed to work, and the kids can't go to school, and they have no money. And as winter gets worse, they get colder and colder in their little apartment.
Wasim's story could be emblematic of the kind of people that America would naturally welcome, but Wasim's story could be the natural kind of emblem of exactly who America would welcome in this crisis. But in fact, the welcome has been full of delays and bureaucratic nightmares of all kinds. Why isn't Wasim in the United States?
He received admission alongside the rest of his family. And then, you know, he had his flight booked. The U.S. government had done everything besides they hadn't undergone their final medical exams. Then 10 days before they were leaving, their suitcases were packed, everything. He got a call saying that for some mysterious security reason, he'd been put on hold. Now, what that could be, there are a series of hypotheticals of what that could be. That could be that his name sounds like somebody else's on a watch list. They have in their family a man who defected early on from the Assad regime. That could be a ding against them. There's no answer. And while he waits, his family wouldn't have come to the United States without him. He was the one who was supposed to work to support them. And at the same time, while he waits, he becomes less and less able to really get by in Jordan. And very soon, if he doesn't hear from the United States, as he says, if smuggling season begins in the spring before he's heard, he'll go to Europe, even though that will be risking his children's lives.
And once you get to Europe, I understand, and this is the situation for the daughters in Holland, arriving in a safe country means the United States isn't going to take your case seriously anymore.
They won't take you. Yeah, that's exactly right. Once you have gotten to a safe country, a safe second party country, you're not eligible to be resettled. What's more, you know, the sisters went over borders when those borders were more porous. When Wasim faces taking the kids in a couple of months, those borders are on lockdown. And one of the ways that I hadn't understood that really startled me is the reason people are furtive and secretive about trying to get over the borders is they don't want their fingerprint taken. As soon as your fingerprint is taken in a country, that's your country of refuge. That's where you have to stay.
What is the message from all these different programs and, you know, statuses and the what looks like, at least from your reporting, that this family will never be reunited?
I mean, the problem is these people are stuck. They're stuck so profoundly in what was bureaucracy, essentially bureaucratic hurdles, until this fall. And after Paris, those bureaucratic hurdles have been exponentially increased by the political fight happening in the United States. And so what – so the governor of Illinois, where Wasim is waiting to go, has said he will not allow any more Syrian refugees to enter the state. So will they be reunited? God, you know, in the next decade, probably not.
Is there anger directed at any particular place in the United States? Is it at the rhetoric? Is it at the government?
I would say they're not angry. They're afraid. And they're afraid, most of all, that their son isn't going to make it to the United States. And I really don't know what they'll do then.
Eliza Griswold has a piece on the Al-Hajli family in this week's New York Times Magazine. Thank you so much, Eliza.
John, thanks so much.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.